Good morning. I'd like you to be opening your Bibles this morning. 1 Corinthians chapter 10.
1 Corinthians chapter 10 in your Bibles today. We'll read from there in just a moment to get us started. Glad to see you. Good to be here. To our visitors, and we do have a number of visitors with us today. We're glad that you are here and worshiping God with us. We're thankful for the encouragement of your presence. Love for you to stick around afterwards and talk to us a little bit about who you are and what brought you our way and how we can help you know God better. Or if you'd rather leave a visitor's card behind and we can follow up with you at a later date, you just let us know and feel free to do that as well. But we're glad that you are here this morning. I want to start reading in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 this morning, verse 1 beginning. Let's read. Apostle Paul writes and says, "For I don't want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all ate drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things happen as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things, as they also craved. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, 'The people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play.' Nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it." Here what we have is the Apostle Paul reminding Christians of the first century to remember their Bible history, to remember in particular the history of the people of Israel, and how tragically that Exodus generation story ended with nothing but a bunch of corpses in the desert. In particular, God reminds Christians to remember. Paul says, "I don't want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea." And so God reminds Christians both of the literal facts of what God did when he delivered his people from Egypt. You remember that they were led by the pillar of cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night. And God led them first, even in the wilderness, by parting the Red Sea. And the pursuing Egyptians were destroyed when the sea covered back over them. And so God works a mighty miracle, a great deliverance, and then faithfully leads his people. And Paul wants Christians to see the analogy. That was Israel's baptism. That was when God delivered them from the slavery of Egypt to basically life as his people, as they journeyed to Sinai and received the covenant. And Paul, in a sense, wants us to see that that was their baptism. And you've been baptized too. You were immersed in water. You, in a sense, passed through the sea. Well, not literally like Israel did, but you individually, everyone who's a Christian, when you were baptized, that was just like Israel passing through the sea. And you've been there. And you've done that too. And then they get in the wilderness, and God provides for them. All ate the same spiritual food. And all drank the same spiritual drink. And ultimately, it was the principle of Christ that was going on there. And at the end of the day, that's what happened for Israel. Remember, they get in the wilderness and they need something to eat. So what does God do? He feeds them with the bread of angels. He sends manna from heaven. And when there's no water to drink, sometimes he purified it. But all other times, he split the rock and had water come from the rock. And thus, his people were provided. But these great events, these provisions and these deliverances, that they should have been, and you and I sometimes look at these stories, and I'm sure we've all done it, we shake our heads and say, how could they not be convinced? How could they not be motivated to be faithful? But verse 5 comes along and says, nevertheless, in other words, despite all that's happened, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness, which is a polite way of saying that they all died in the wilderness. Despite what God had done for them, and despite the fact that they had been baptized just like you've been baptized, they died outside the promised land under God's judgment. Well, what happened? What happened to Israel in the wilderness? Well, Paul begins to go on and to explain in the following verses, starting in verse 6, what happened in the wilderness, or excuse me, verse 7. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. And so they were idolaters. Even at Sinai, when Moses is up on the mountain getting the rest of the law, they're making the golden calf. Remember the story? Nor let us act immorally as some of them did, as 23,000 fell in one day. Now, there were several incidents of sexual immorality in Israel's history, even in the wilderness, but in particular, what Paul's referring to here is Numbers chapter 25 and the Baal Peor incident, where under Balaam's direction, the Moabites enticed the nation as a whole to engage in great sexual immorality across the nation. And God sent a plague that began to destroy his people for their immorality. And tens of thousands were killed. Nor, verse 9, nor let us try the Lord, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents. And there, Paul reminds us of what happens in Numbers chapter 21. The story of, remember, the fiery serpents that came in judgment against God's people for their sin. And Moses was told by God to put the brazen serpent up on the rod, on the pole. And when the people looked at that, they were spared from death at the hands of the fiery serpents. Nor, verse 10, nor grumble, as some of them did. And they were destroyed by the destroyer. What's Paul talking about there? Well, most likely what Paul's talking about there is the story that led to the ultimate death of the generation as a whole. The generation that came out in the Exodus, the generation that had seen the parting of the sea, experienced God's deliverance, and ate his manna and drunk his miraculous water, that generation was condemned to death when they grumbled against God at Kadesh Barnea, when the spies came back from looking out the land. Now here's the thing we've got to understand. Paul makes very clear as he moves on into verse 12. Therefore, looking at what's happened to Israel, they were baptized like you were. They had a great start, but they died outside of their reward. Let him who thinks he stand takes heed that he does not fall. It's important to understand that just because you start well does not mean you're going to finish and receive God's reward. In fact, that chapter 10 really comes at a really unfortunate place. That big number 10 in 1 Corinthians for us comes at really a very unfortunate place, because it separates us from the larger context of what Paul's been doing in 1 Corinthians, leading into this section where he reminds Christians of Israel's advantages and of Israel's failures and how tragic it was that they died outside the land. Because if you look back at chapter 9, beginning just before where we've been reading, Paul says this. He says, do you not know that those who run in the race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. And I discipline my body and make it my slave so that, look at what Paul says now, after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. And then Paul launches into where we've been reading. Do you understand what Paul's saying there, though? Paul's saying that he sits there and he understands that you've, even though basically God will save all that are faithful and willing, the way that you live the kind of faithful life that's required to make it into God's eternal glory is you basically live it as though there's only one prize out there and you're going to strive to be the one to get it. That's how people run a race, with everything they've got, because there's only one prize to go around. And so you give it everything you've got. Paul says that's the focus and the intensity with which we live, because as Paul makes clear in that last verse 27 of chapter 9, he understands that even though he has preached to others, he himself could be disqualified. In other words, Paul's very well aware that even though he works and serves God as an apostle of the Lord Jesus Christ, he understands it's entirely possible for him to, even though he's told others the truth and others will be saved because of his preaching, it's still entirely possible for Paul to live in such a way so that he would be condemned in the last day. Isn't that a stunning thing to think about? That even though others will be saved through Paul's effort, it's entirely possible that Paul could still stumble, that Paul could in some way lose his life. He could think, I stand, I'm an apostle, and wind up falling in the end. Paul says, oh, don't you remember the story of our Jewish forefathers? They were baptized, they started well, they went to Sinai, they saw the fire in the mountain, and yet, nevertheless, God was not well pleased with them, and they were laid low. Remember the stories Paul says? Remember the golden calf? Remember the fiery serpent? Remember the sexual immorality? You remember Kadesh Barnea? You remember what happened? It's a stunning and important warning that Christians, I think, today, we need to remember that just because we've started well and just because we're here does not mean that necessarily the story will always have a happy ending. In particular, this morning, though, I really want to focus upon one aspect of Paul's list. Because we get idolatry, and we get that we shouldn't do that. And we get sexual immorality. We talk about it a lot in this day, in this debased age that we find ourselves in. And we get that. But testing the Lord and grumbling in particular, that's a little bit more sobering, isn't it? That's a little more sobering because that's a lot easier to do in some ways than all that goes into committing sexual immorality or all the trouble and expense to getting into idolatry. Grumbling. Let's talk about that for just a couple minutes this morning. I want to talk with you for just a couple minutes about avoiding Israel's downfall. And in particular, I want to talk about what Paul points us to in terms of the issue of their dying, their grumbling against God and being laid low because of it. In one sense, with the people of God, there was a legacy of grumbling as soon as they came out of Egypt. It was just a matter of 3 days past the sea when they began to grumble against God for the first time. And one of the great things that always seemed to happen with the people of God in their frequent grumblings in Exodus and Numbers, the two books that tell most of the stories, one of the things that often seems to happen is that Israel lives so much in the present, she forgets the past. And when she does think about the past, it's almost as though, you know, God's done so much in the past. Surely he can't do anything in the future. I mean, it's always astounding. You know, God must have used up all his power parting the sea. God doesn't know anything about water. We're just gonna die of thirst out here in the wilderness because God can't do anything with water. It's like we expect God's power to be used up after he's helped us so much. He has to go somewhere and recharge for a while or something. Have your Bible still. Go back with me to the book of Numbers, chapter 13, chapter 14. Let's look here for just a moment. Verse 25, Numbers 13. And when they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron, to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And thus they told them and said, "We went in the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey. This is the fruit. Nevertheless," that's a dangerous word, isn't it? "The people who live in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev. The Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country. And the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan." And Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "We should by all means go up, take possession of it. We will surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people. They are too strong for us." And so they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people who we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, part of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. And all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried." The people wept that night. Why'd they cry? Because they believed what the faithless spies had said, that it's hopeless and impossible. So all the sons of Israel, look at what that word is, grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness." And of course, you know what's going to happen. God's going to say, "Well, that can be arranged. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" And so they said to one another, "Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt." And Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, of those who spied out the land, they tore their clothes, and they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "The land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land, if the Lord is pleased with us." But see, that's the thing. What does Paul pick up on? Nevertheless, the Lord was not pleased with them. But Joshua and Caleb understand how this works. If we're faithful, if we're obedient, if we're respectful, if the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land, give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared and attended to all the sons of Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long will this people spurn me? And how long will they not believe in me despite the signs which I have performed in their midst?" And Moses, of course, will beg God to spare the people. And God will respond when you drop down to verse 20. "I have pardoned them according to your word. But indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, and yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurned me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has had a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring him to the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it." Verse 26, "The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, 'How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I have heard the complaints of the sons of Israel that they are making against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you.'" See that? They wanted to die in the wilderness. God says, "I can make that happen. I heard what you said. As you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses will fall in this wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me." See the emphasis there? It's not just faithlessness. It's not just a spirit of rebellion. It's the grumbling. Especially by this point in the story, after all the provision, all the miracles. Listen, by this point in the story, they've been to Sinai. They've seen the fire. They've seen the mountain shake. They've seen the tablets given. They've seen miracles upon miracles. And yet they grumble against God. As God makes very clear, the people who have seen what I am capable of and yet grumble, those are the ones who are going to miss out. Those who live so much in the present that they forget the power of the past. And so we see, ladies and gentlemen, that grumbling really, as common as it is in daily life, I mean, we get idolatry, we get to sexual immorality, but as common as grumbling is in daily life, as easy as it is to fall into that kind of an activity, that kind of an attitude and action, and how seriously God takes that, especially when it's grumbling directed against him or toward him or about him. And how seriously he takes it. And of all the words and all the verbs and all the ways that God could describe why he was so upset there at Kadesh, it's the grumbling that lit the fuse of the fire of the wrath of the Almighty. I want to think with you for just a couple minutes this morning, the last couple minutes that we have together, about how to avoid Israel's downfall, especially when it comes to the grumbling that is so easy to fall into in life. 3 quick observations and we will be done. Number one, let's understand that when it comes to grumbling, that there's a difference in talking to God. In other words, casting our cares upon him, expressing our pain and our anguish and our concern and our fears. There's a difference in talking to God and a difference in talking about God. I want you to notice in Numbers 14 and verse 3. Where we just were reading, I want you to notice in particular what the people say. The people are not talking to God about their concerns. What are they doing? They are talking about God. Look at what happens. "Why is the Lord bringing us up into this land to fall by the sword?" What are they doing? You know, all questions have assumptions that lay behind them. Assumptions. If I ask you, are you still cheating on tests? What's the assumption in my question? That you already cheat on tests. When they say, when they raise the question, why is the Lord bringing us this land to fall by the sword? What are the implied assumptions about the nature of God and how he treats them? Are they honorable assumptions about God's nature and about his kindness and about his competence? Or is the assumption in that question that God is not competent, that God is not careful, that God is not caring? They're not talking to God. They're not crying in prayer to God. They're talking about God. They are grumbling against God. Their gripe, their grumbling was not about the problem as such. Their grumbling was about God himself. Ladies and gentlemen, there's a difference in sitting there and saying life is hard and I'm uncertain and I'm scared and there's a lot of pain and there's a lot of things that don't make sense in my life. There's a difference in admitting that life is hard, that life is confusing, that life does not always make sense. And they're starting to say things like, what good has it done me to follow God in the first place? To start accusing God of injustice or unfairness, as though we know everything he knows or as though we have the sense of wisdom or justice that he has. See, it's really interesting. When you look at people who suffered well in the Bible, who came to difficult situations in which they were scared or confused or conflicted, it's interesting to notice how those who handled it well spoke. Take Job, for instance. Job, who suffers unfairly. And Job, who never knows the source or the reason of his suffering. We know the story, but no one in the story ever bothers to tell Job. God doesn't. Satan doesn't. No angel shows up. Job has no idea why what seems to be unjust, unfair suffering that is absolutely unconnected to who he is and how he's lived his life, why all this is happening to him. And yet in Job 1, verse 21, Job arose, he tore his robe, he shaved his head. It's fine to be upset, it's hard, it's fine to be hurt, it's fine to say, this hurts. But he fell to the ground and he worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I will return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. And through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he, and look what the text says next, nor did he blame God. Was his refusal to blame God a product of him having all the answers? Not at all. He has no idea. And as the story goes on, it's going to become very clear that Job is hurting. Job is frustrated. But even as the stakes are ratcheted up, even as the suffering increases in Job 2, beginning of verse 7, so Satan goes out from the presence of the Lord, smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He took a potsherd to scrape himself when he was sitting among the ashes. And his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. What's she inviting Job to do? Not just talk to God about it. She's inviting Job to talk about God, to blame God, to curse God, to grumble against God. But he responded to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we not indeed accept good from God and not adversity? And in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Or if we had time, we could multiply examples. We could talk about how Jesus approaches his Father in the garden and on the cross. One of the things that we learn in the Bible is, when we look at the examples of those who suffer well, and get through life successfully in God's eyes, is that the key is that we take our complaints to God rather than making our complaints about God. That in no way is God ever the object of the complaint. We can complain to God, but we cannot complain about God. And that's number one. Number two, when it comes to avoiding the sins of Israel that led to their loss in the wilderness, number two, we need to understand there's a difference in being frustrated and versus giving up. There's a difference in being frustrated versus giving up. God nowhere in his Bible, either by command or by the examples that he's given us, expects us to chuck or somehow leave behind the fact that we are also emotional beings who cry and are afraid, who hurt and who weep. People who are sometimes confused by life and the apparent senselessness of how the world works out. God nowhere expects us to set aside our humanity in that area or in that regard. God knows what it's like to be us because of Jesus and who he lived and how he died. One of the things that we learn as we read the Bible carefully then is that it is okay to be frustrated. It's different to give up, though. It's interesting. And you see this dynamic again. Let's use Job for a minute in particular, because Job, there's so much of the book of Job is given to outlining for sharing with us Job's thoughts and Job's words. In Job chapter 10, it looks like Job's starting to lose it. In Job 10, beginning verse 18, he begins to lose it. He says to God, he says, "Why have you brought me out of the womb? Would that I had died, no eye had seen me. I should have been as though I had not been, carried from womb to tomb." Oh, Job had style, man. From womb to tomb. "I wish that was me, God. If you knew this was going to be my lot in life, why'd you ever let me see the light of day?" It looks like Job's starting to lose it, but then you drop down to chapter 13. And listen to how Job comes back around. And now he says, verse 15, "Though he slay me, I will hope in him. Nevertheless, I will argue my ways before him." And that's a powerful verse, ladies and gentlemen, because what happens in Job 13 and verse 15? What does Job do? He straddles this divide that we're talking about. He straddles it, and he straddles it rightly, and he straddles it well. He is frustrated. "I will argue my ways with him. I will let him know, though, my complaints. But I'm not going to make it about him. I'm going to make it about the problem." It's not about God, though. It's not about him. He's not under question here. "Though he slay me, I will still hope in him. God's my God no matter what. But that doesn't mean I can't be frustrated. That doesn't mean I can't cry out. That doesn't mean I can't complain about the problems of life and the way it hurts. As long as I don't make it about God instead of talking to God." Does that make sense? And Job's a great example of straddling that dynamic. Even though life is unfair and life makes no sense to Job, Job makes very clear that I'm going to straddle this divide. I am frustrated. I need to talk about God. We're going to talk about it. I'm going to make sure that you hear everything I've got to say about this, but you are still my God. I am frustrated, but I am not giving up. And number three, thirdly and finally this morning, to avoid the grumbling that was Israel's downfall in the wilderness, the grumbling ultimately that led to their demise, we don't understand the difference between what we can't control versus what we can control. You know what I can't control? I can't control ultimately what happens with my health. I can't control the other car drivers on the road around me when I come to and from work, the building, worship services, or wherever else I go. I can't control the actions of other people and what they may do to me. Scary thing, as a parent, I ultimately can't control the decisions my children make when they grow up. One of my favorite definitions of a parent: to be a parent is never to have a good night's sleep again. Because free will is will, real. And I'll give them everything I can, but ultimately they'll make their own decisions and I can't control them. I just don't want them to realize that too soon. There are a lot of things in life that we can't control. There are some things that we can. One of the interesting things to think about when it comes to the Bible and what it tells us about the difference between what we can and what we can't control when it comes to our own lives and how we stand before God is this. Now, I want you to think about it. In the Bible, generally, we don't see any kind of passages or texts that tell us how to feel. You say, "Oh, Jeff, what about love?" Yeah, but the Bible doesn't use the word love like we do. Love's a decision. Love's a commitment. Love's a faithfulness. The way we use the word love in our culture, we're conditioned to think about love as an emotion, the erotic side of love, the emotional side of love, the infatuated side of love. In the Bible, love's a long-lasting commitment. Now, it may have an emotional component, but love at its root is that covenanted commitment, the faithfulness, the putting the other person's best interests and needs before your own. That's not so much emotion, that's will, a different part of the person altogether. And the Bible generally, the Bible doesn't so much tell us how to feel, because you know what? The Bible understands, God who made us understands that our emotions, in a lot of ways, our emotions are largely spontaneous. I mean, when somebody cuts me off on the road, what's my usual emotional response when that happens for virtually all of us, yours and mine? There's a flash of anger. And it's spontaneous. Now, as I get older, I mature, maybe I learn to control it more. Maybe I've lowered my expectations upon life and Texas drivers, and maybe I'm just not surprised when that happens. But you know what I'm talking about. There are a lot of times in life where we have that spontaneous emotional response that is really beyond our control. What is within our control, though, is not the initial emotion, but what we allow that emotion to lead us to do. I cannot always control how I feel in the moment. I can control what that feeling pushes me to do. I have control over my actions. I have control over whether I allow the emotion that arises spontaneously because of what's done to me or what happens around me. I have control over whether that emotion is allowed to fester, to grow, to put down root. Whether that initial flash of anger when I'm cut off on the road is allowed to gnaw at me to where I tail the guy and ride his bumper until I find a good way to make sure that he knows I'm there and I'm not happy. We can't always choose how we feel. We can always choose how we're going to act, how we're going to think, how we're going to respond, what we're going to focus on, which emotions we're going to feed so that they flourish. It's not wrong to feel sad. It's not wrong to feel pain. It's wrong to allow those things to fester into grumbling, where now it's about God, where now we've gone past being frustrated and being hurt to giving up, where we go past what we can't control and allow it to affect the things that we can. Grumbling, at the end of the day, it's an action, not an emotion. It's what we do because of the emotion that we don't control and that we don't channel in God-pleasing and God-given ways. And ultimately, because usually the grumbling that destroys us, the grumbling that becomes a habit, and by the way, the Old Testament makes clear that with Israel, it'd become a habit. It wasn't just they had a one bad day in Kadesh there, and God just says, that's it, I can't take these people anymore, because God has a hair-trigger temper. No. These 10 times, he says, it's a habit. The grumbling's become a lifestyle. This is who and what you are. You've had chances to turn. I've spared you before, but this has become who and what you are. You've allowed it to fester, to grow, and now it controls you rather than you controlling it. Grumbling has become part of who and what you are. Part of what happens, ladies and gentlemen, as the text makes clear and as God indicates, they don't think about the great wonders I've done in the past. We begin to realize, ladies and gentlemen, that at the end of the day, what we can control is our attitude towards God overall. Why is it in our thinking too often the hurts and the pains and the apparent failures of the Almighty, unanswered prayers according to our perceptions, are the things that weigh the largest, and too often all the good that he has done looms least? God says they're so focused on the problems of the moment that they've forgotten all the good that's happened along the way to get them here. The fact that they're even here today to grumble at all is a mark of how much good I've done, how many miracles have been wrought on their behalf. I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of the day, it's Thanksgiving, which in some ways really isn't natural to human beings. I don't have to teach my kids to grumble. I do have to teach them to say please and thank you. To intentionally, because we can control this, foster an attitude of gratitude, of thanksgiving, that's a great antidote to the sometimes overwhelming temptation to grumble against the Almighty. Whether it's the psalmist in Psalm 100, starting about verse 4 or so, the way he puts it, enter his gates with thanksgiving, his courts with praise, give thanks to him, bless his name, because the Lord is good. Even the bad times, the dark times, the confusing times, the seemingly and apparently, and quite possibly unfair times, he's still good. And his loving kindness, his faithfulness to his people is everlasting. Oh, it may not look like it today, but you know what? I'm going to go and confess it anyways. Because even though my circumstances argue otherwise, I'm convinced it's true. There's too many stories, too many miracles, too much goodness along the way for it to be otherwise. Or the way Paul put it in Colossians 4 and verse 2, devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving. And that may be the surest key of all right there. Prayer focused upon thanksgiving. Oh, definitely, complain to God, cry to God when the circumstances of life warrant it. He does want to hear and feel our pain and walk in the dark places with us. But at the end of the day, it's prayer committed to thanksgiving that keeps our hearts from allowing the sometimes overwhelming evil of this world, the people that in it, and the time and chance that stalks us all. From allowing the overwhelming evil of the world to ruin us and change us and cause us to become the people who were so close to eternity yet lost in the way because they grumbled and gave up. And you realize that's maybe the greatest tragedy of the stories it brings to a close. One of the greatest tragedies of the story is they were there at the doorstep of the land. All that was really left at that point was for God to just basically push them over the hump. They were there. Kadesh was the doorway to the promised land. But they refused to pray with thanksgiving. They refused to give thanks to God. They made it about God. And God said, therefore, all you have seen what I'm capable of, you die here. We'll have it your way. You're here this morning, you're not a child of God. Listen, we want you to get your life right with God. We want you to be baptized into His fellowship, into His kingdom, become part of His people. And you can do that this morning upon your good confession that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and in your heart repenting of your sins and your participation in the world. We have water. We have the time. We'd like for nothing better than to help you pass through the sea and enter into the freedom of the sons of God. Here this morning, you're a child of God already, but you recognize that maybe something in your life is like Israel before you, putting you at risk of dying in the wilderness, of not seeing what you've begun so well through to the end. Pray to God for forgiveness, however it is. Whether it's some of the things we didn't talk about this morning, the idolatry of the age, the greed, the covetousness. Maybe it's sexual immorality. Or maybe it is the grumbling heart. Way more prevalent, all too common, something that all of us have to constantly work at to make sure it does not prevail. And our attitudes toward God and the way that we live before Him. If we can help you in some way, encourage you, strengthen you, why don't you come talk to us? Why don't you come lean on us right now while we stand and while we sing?